So it's early 2026, and I want to try to paint a picture of a moment that, it fundamentally shifted how cybersecurity experts view the whole architecture of modern
Oh,
surveillance.
absolutely.
Yeah, so there's this researcher, Mark Hoffer, and he's conducting what is basically just a routine scan of the open internet. He's looking for exposed ports, vulnerabilities, like the kind of digital loose ends that system administrators just forget to tie up.
Right, just everyday digital hygiene stuff.
Exactly. And during this sweep, his automated tools flag a server. And this server is sitting in Zhangjiakou, which is that Chinese city in Hebei province, the one that co-hosted the 2022 Winter Olympics.
I remember that, yeah.
So Hoffer investigates, and he's probably expecting to find, I don't know, a misconfigured corporate database or a leaky email server or something. But instead, he finds an open door, like no password prompt,
Wow.
no encryption keys required. He simply clicks, and he is just inside.
And I mean, what he is looking at is not just some static list of files, it's a live, breathing interface. He essentially stumbled into the back end of a fully operational police dashboard built by the Chinese Ministry of State Security.
Which is terrifying.
Oh, yeah. The internal name they used for it was the Dynamic Control Platform for Overseas Personnel. It wasn't an archive, it was this active, real-time tracking machine.
Well, welcome to this Brain Candy episode from Clara and Horatio. We are starting with this exposed server in Zhangjiakou because honestly, it serves as the ultimate blueprint for a very specific kind of control.
It really does.
Because when we look at this Chinese platform, we instantly recognize it as the absolute pinnacle of a centralized surveillance state. I mean, it is top-down, authoritarian, state-mandated. But the core question we have to ask today, the thing we're going to tear apart piece by piece, is whether the United States is quietly approaching that exact same functional capability.
Just taking a completely different route to get there.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, we don't have a state-run dynamic control platform,
Yeah.
but have we essentially built the exact same machine by patching together commercial data brokers, intelligence programs, local AI cameras, and border search powers?
Have we bought our way into a surveillance state?
Right.
And, to really understand the gravity of that question, we have to look at the mechanics of what Mark Hoffer actually found on that Chinese platform.
So what was actually in there?
Well, it wasn't just a digitized phone book of foreign journalists or international students and expats. There were about 12,000 individual profiles, but the real terror was in the integration.
The way it pulled things together.
Exactly. The platform operated like this massive vacuum. It was constantly ingesting CCTV facial recognition feeds from public streets.
Wow.
But not just that, it pulled in exact seat assignments from the high-speed rail network. It logged the precise timestamps of hotel check-ins
Wait, precise timestamps.
down to the second. It even vacuumed up guest logs from the Taiwu Ski Resort and records of routine visits to local hospitals.
So it's taking all these completely disparate threads of a person's life threads that, in a normal society, exist in completely separate silo databases, and it weaves them all together.
Right, but the most sophisticated part of this machine wasn't just tracking where a person went. That's basic. It was a feature called relational mapping.
Relational mapping. Let's unpack that because that is where things get really intense.
Yeah, so relational mapping completely changes the paradigm of surveillance. The system didn't just plot a foreign journalist's movements on a map. By synchronizing the facial recognition timestamps across hundreds of different cameras, the AI could identify who that journalist was physically near.
Oh, wow. So it's building a web.
Yes, it automatically mapped out social networks based entirely on shared physical encounters. So, say an international student and an expat both happen to be in the same coffee shop at 9 in the morning. And then 15 minutes later, their faces are scanned entering the same subway station. The platform automatically draws a relational line between them. It categorizes people by perceived risk level based purely on their associations.
And no human is even looking at
No.
this.
All without a human analyst ever needing to intervene. The machine does it all.
Okay, so let me just establish a very firm baseline here before we go any further. Because I want to be clear, America and China are fundamentally different societies.
Absolutely.
We operate under a completely different legal and constitutional framework. If, say, the FBI decides they want to build a relational map tracking every time I grab a drink with a political activist, they cannot simply mandate that my local pub install a facial recognition camera with a direct fiber optic feed to Quantico.
No, but they cannot.
Right. Our government does not have that kind of centralized state-mandated architecture.
That structural difference is undeniable. But here's the thing. The absence of a mandate does not mean the absence of the capability. The workaround we are seeing in the United States relies heavily on the free market. If you want to assemble a highly complex puzzle, you don't actually need to manufacture the cardboard and print the image yourself.
And just buy the pieces.
You simply purchase the individual pieces from different commercial vendors and snap them together.
So it's a surveillance market.
Exactly. The American model is a surveillance market. It's assembled from foreign intelligence collection, expansive border powers, local municipal cameras, and vast troves of commercial data. And all of it is glued together by modern AI systems that are uniquely capable of fusing those pieces into a coherent narrative.
So, to understand how we arrived at a place where this kind of infrastructure can just be purchased off the shelf, I think we have to rewind the clock.
We have to go back to 2013.
Right, 2013, the Snowden disclosures. Because looking back from where we are now, a massive psychological shift has occurred. I mean, over a decade ago, these revelations stopped the world in its tracks. People were outraged.
It was headline news globally for months.
Exactly. But today, the concept of mass surveillance has largely just faded into background noise. It's just a thing we all kind of accept.
How did we normalize this so quickly?
Well, the normalization happened partly because the technical mechanisms were incredibly difficult for the general public to visualize.
They were just too abstract.
Right. The Snowden leaks exposed two distinct programs authorized under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. These programs are known as PRISM and Upstream Collection, and they operate on completely different mechanical principles.
Okay, well, let's pull those apart, starting with PRISM, because this is often referred to as downstream collection, right?
Right.
So in this scenario, the National Security Agency goes directly to the massive U.S. tech providers. We are talking companies like Google, Microsoft, Meta, Yahoo, and they compel them to produce data.
But the crucial detail here is that they aren't hooking up a massive hose to Google's entire server farm and draining it.
Right. They use specific selectors. Yes, selectors. If they are tracking a foreign intelligence target, they hand over a specific email address or a phone number, and the tech company extracts the data associated with that specific selector.
So that targeted approach, that's the hallmark of PRISM. It is a compelled extraction from a stored database.
Exactly. Upstream collection, however, is a much more aggressive and expansive posture. Programs bearing code names like Fairview and Stormbrew fall under this umbrella. Here, the NSA doesn't wait for the data to be stored on a Google server.
They tap into the pipes.
They tap directly into the internet backbone itself.
So we are talking about the physical infrastructure of the internet here.
Yeah.
Like the massive fiber optic cables that run along the ocean floor and emerge at landing stations on the coast.
Yes, the physical pipes. And to understand how upstream works, you have to understand how data actually travels. Mm-hmm. Information on the internet is broken down into tiny packets of light pulsing through glass fibers.
Right.
Intelligence agencies install optical splitters at major physical telecommunication switches. And these splitters literally clone the pulses of light.
So they just mirror everything.
They mirror the entire data stream without interrupting the original signal flowing to its destination. And then they filter this massive high-volume traffic in real time.
Wow.
And because internet routing is designed for efficiency rather than geography, an email sent from a user in Ohio to a user in Pennsylvania might bounce through a server in Frankfurt.
So pulling in foreign intelligence at these major junctions inevitably sweeps up the domestic communications of U.S. citizens.
Exactly. You cast a net that wide, you catch a lot of domestic data.
And this sweeping up of domestic data was the core of that whole not wittingly controversy, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Because prior to the Snowden leaks, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper famously sat before Congress, and Senator Ron Wyden asked him directly. He asked if the NSA collected any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans.
And Clapper answered, "No, sir, not wittingly."
And that testimony became the massive flashpoint for the entire debate about oversight and government secrecy.
Well, Clapper later described his answer as the least untruthful response he could give in an unclassified setting. He argued he was thinking specifically of the collection of the content of communications.
Right, the actual words being spoken or written.
Exactly. But that defense highlighted a massive blind spot in public understanding during the Snowden era. And that blind spot is the concept of metadata. Under programs operating through Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the government wasn't necessarily recording the audio of domestic phone calls in bulk. They were collecting the metadata in bulk.
You know, for years, The default way to explain metadata to the public has been to compare it to a phone bill.
Right, the itemized bill.
Yeah, people were told, don't worry, they aren't listening to the call. They just have the itemized bill showing you called specific number at a specific time for a specific duration. But I honestly think that analogy is fundamentally flawed because it makes metadata sound boring.
It makes it sound harmless.
Exactly. It makes it sound like accounting. It's not accounting.
So how would you conceptualize it for you?
I think of metadata more like hiring a team of private investigators to follow you around, but with one strict rule. They are not allowed to listen to a single word you say.
Okay, I like that.
But all they can do is log every door you enter, note the exact second you cross the threshold, log every person you shake hands with, and record how long you spend in their presence.
Right.
I mean, they don't need to hear your actual conversation with a divorce attorney or an oncologist or a bankruptcy court clerk. The pattern of the doors you walk through tells the entire story of your life.
That is a highly accurate representation of how algorithms process this information. I mean, the content of a communication is actually quite messy to deal with.
Because humans are messy.
Exactly. If you have the audio of a phone call, you have to assign a human analyst or a really complex natural language processing AI to transcribe it, understand the context, decode sarcasm, figure out what they actually mean.
Right.
Metadata, by contrast, is perfectly structured. It is clean. It consists of times, dates, durations, and node identifiers. It is the absolute ideal fuel for machine learning.
And that's the key, isn't it?
By analyzing those data points, algorithms can map your associations, your habits, your daily routines, and your deepest vulnerabilities. It allows for the exact same kind of relational mapping we saw on that Chinese platform we talked about earlier. But instead of physical CCTV cameras, it uses the digital exhaust of our communications.
And that digital exhaust is only growing. So let's move from the NSA tapping the internet backbone to the CIA targeting the actual devices sitting in our living rooms.
Vault 7.
Right. In 2017, WikiLeaks published Vault 7, which was this massive dump of internal CIA documents detailing their whole library of zero-day exploits and malware. And the program that absolutely terrified the public was called Weeping Angel.
Co-developed with Britain's MI5, Weeping Angel was engineered to target a very specific line of Samsung smart televisions.
The psychological terror of this program was its fake-off mode. The documentation showed that the malware could suppress the LEDs on the television screen.
It was incredibly deceptive.
Right, so a user in their living room hits the power button on the remote, the screen goes black, the little red light turns off, and by all visual metrics, the TV is powered down. But it was actually still running in the background, maintaining its Wi-Fi connection, and it hijacks the microphone built into the television or the remote to record ambient audio in the room.
And it was transmitting those conversations back to a CIA server.
Which is wild.
It is. The capability to turn a television into a covert listening device is deeply unsettling. I won't argue that. But we really need to place a very firm factual guardrail on this discussion right now.
Okay, let's do that.
Because this is exactly where the public narrative often spirals into techno-paranoia. The Vault 7 leaks did not prove that the United States government possesses some magical master switch that can silently activate every single microphone and camera in the country at will.
Let me stop you there, because the immediate reaction from anyone hearing about Weeping Angel is to stare at their own smart TV and wonder if the government is listening to them argue about what to make for dinner, you know?
Of course.
So what were the actual operational limits of this malware?
Well, we have to distinguish between possessing a highly powerful targeted device exploitation tool and conducting routine mass surveillance. They are not the same thing.
Right.
Weeping Angel was not a dragnet. It targeted the Samsung F-series specifically. Furthermore, deploying it was incredibly resource intensive. To initially compromise the television, intelligence officers often required physical access to the device.
Wait, really? Like they had to be in the room?
Yes. It usually meant someone had to break into the location and plug in a booby-trapped USB drive. And even if they tried a remote deployment, it relied on exploiting highly specific, unpatched firmware vulnerabilities.
Meaning if the consumer simply updated their television software, the back door was just slammed shut.
Exactly. Modern hardened operating systems utilizing hardware-level encryption are remarkably resilient today. Turning a compromised device into a sensor requires authorization, it requires massive deployment logistics, and sustained technical effort.
So it's not just a push-button operation.
Yeah. No. The fact that the CIA had a tool to hack a specific model of TV for a targeted espionage operation is fundamentally different from the NSA passively scooping up billions of metadata records from the internet backbone.
Okay, that makes sense. But I think the very existence of Weeping Angel points to why modern surveillance feels so insidious. You know, when people think of a surveillance state, they almost always think of George Orwell's 1984.
Right, the classic example.
But Orwell's vision was entirely industrial and coercive. The telescreens in 1984 were bolted to the wall by the government. They were ugly, they blared state propaganda all day, and you were forced to have them in your home. Our surveillance ecosystem looks nothing like that.
Orwell imagined a world where surveillance was inflicted upon the public against their will. Modern surveillance is actively desired.
We wait in line for it.
Exactly. It is commercial, and it is hidden inside ordinary, highly convenient services. We voluntarily stand in line overnight to pay $1,000 for a device equipped with multiple high-definition cameras, constantly connected microphones, and a military-grade GPS tracker.
And we carry it in our pockets literally everywhere we go.
We do. We actively prompt our smart speakers to listen to our voices because, well, it saves us the minor inconvenience of pushing buttons to turn on the lights or play a movie. The tracking is no longer a government mandate. It is simply the price of convenience in a digital society.
So, if we are voluntarily carrying these hyper-advanced tracking devices, how is the legal system handling the fallout? Because the Fourth Amendment protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Right.
It requires the government to get a warrant supported by probable cause. But that amendment was written in the late 18th century. It was designed to protect physical papers stored in wooden desks inside physical houses.
It certainly wasn't designed for the cloud.
No. Mm-hmm. So for the past decade, the law has essentially been running on a treadmill, just desperately trying to keep pace with a moving phone.
The evolution of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence regarding technology is a fascinating study in judicial adaptation. The Supreme Court has laid down several critical stepping stones to try and bridge the gap between 18th century property law and 21st century digital realities.
Walk through those.
We can trace this evolution clearly in plain English, starting back in 2012 with a case called United States v. Jones.
Okay, in the Jones case, law enforcement suspected a man of drug trafficking, but they didn't have a warrant for his movements. So they physically attached a GPS tracking device to the undercarriage of his Jeep while it was parked in a public lot.
Right, just slapped it on there.
And they monitored his movements continuously for a month. The government argued that because the Jeep was traveling on public roads where anyone could theoretically see it, Jones had no expectation of privacy.
And the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that this prolonged GPS monitoring constituted a Fourth Amendment search. However, the reasoning they used was largely anchored in a traditional property-based theory.
Because they touched his car.
Exactly. The police committed a physical trespass. They touched his personal property to attach the device. The physical intrusion was the primary trigger for the constitutional protection.
But the technology immediately leapfrogged that ruling. You don't need a detective to crawl under a Jeep in the dead of night to attach a GPS tracker anymore. The target is already carrying a way better tracker in their pocket.
Which brings us to the 2014 case, Riley v. California. The police arrested a man, seized his smartphone incident to the arrest, and began manually scrolling through his digital contents without a warrant.
Which they used to be able to do with physical items.
Right. Under traditional law, if the police arrest you, they can search the physical items on your person, like a wallet or a cigarette pack, to ensure officer safety and prevent the destruction of evidence.
But a phone is not a wallet. I remember Chief Justice John Roberts writing the opinion on this, and he essentially said that comparing a modern smartphone to a physical wallet is like saying a ride on horseback is materially indistinguishable from a flight to the moon.
It's a great quote.
It really is. A phone is a portal. It holds the sum total of human life, photographs, bank records, private correspondence, medical searches, everything.
The court recognized a profound quantitative shift that results in a qualitative difference. Because the capacity of the device is so immense, searching it is uniquely intrusive. Therefore, the police generally must secure a warrant to search a cell phone, even during a lawful arrest.
And that recognition of digital vastness really set the stage for the landmark 2018 ruling, right? Carpenter v. United States.
Yes. Carpenter is where the legal theory really had to confront the reality of the cellular network. The government suspected Timothy Carpenter of orchestrating a string of armed robberies, but instead of tapping his phone, they went to his wireless carriers, Sprint and Metro PCS,
okay.
And they used a court order, not a probable cause warrant, to compel the carriers to hand over his cell site location information, or CSLI.
CSLI. And this is generated passively, right?
Entirely passively. Every time your phone connects to the network to route a call, receive a text, or even just fetch email in the background. It pings the nearest cell tower. By analyzing which towers the phone connected to and the angle of the signal, carriers can generate a rough estimate of the device's location.
And the government got a lot of this data on them.
They obtained 127 days of this data for Carpenter, effectively reconstructing his past movements and placing him near the scenes of the robberies.
And the Supreme Court ruled that acquiring this hysterical CSLI requires a warrant. They pointed out that cell phones are such a pervasive and insistent part of daily life that carrying one is indispensable.
You can't really function without one.
You can't. The phone faithfully follows its owner into deeply private spaces, private residences, medical clinics, political headquarters. Gathering that data provides an intimate, time-traveling window into a person's life that goes way beyond anything traditional visual surveillance could ever achieve.
The Carpenter decision was a massive victory for privacy advocates, but it left crucial questions unanswered. The court specifically stated its ruling was narrow, applying to 7 days or more of historical CSLI.
Right. They put a time limit on it.
They did. It did not definitively resolve whether acquiring real-time tracking data or pulling location data for a period shorter than 7 days constituted a search.
And that ambiguity brings us to a massive defining case decided recently in 2026, Chatry v. United States.
Oh, this case.
The facts of this case read like a dystopian techno thriller. And it centers on a practice known as a geofence warrant.
A geofence warrant represents a profound inversion of traditional investigative logic. Historically, law enforcement identifies a suspect and then seeks data about that specific individual.
But that's how it's always worked.
Right. A geofence warrant works backward. The police have a location and a crime scene, but no suspects. So they demand that a tech company identify every single person who was present in that area at that time.
So in the Chatry case, a man robbed a credit union in Midlothian, Virginia. The police were at a dead end, but witnesses noted the robber appeared to be holding a cell phone to his ear.
Okay.
So the detectives went to a magistrate and secured a geofence warrant directed at Google. They drew a virtual circle, a geofence, with a 150 meter radius around the credit union. And they demanded that Google search a specific internal database called SensorVault and identify every single device inside that circle.
To understand the implications of this, we have to contrast it with the CSLI data in the Carpenter case. CSLI relies on cell towers, which might give a location radius of half a mile in a suburban area. It's rough.
Right.
Google's SensorVault stores data generated by a service called Location History. This is not merely ping cell towers. It fuses GPS coordinates, Bluetooth beacons, and Wi-Fi network topography.
It's way more accurate.
It is incredibly precise. It can pinpoint a user's location to within 20 meters, logging coordinates every 2 minutes. It even records barometric pressure to determine elevation.
Wait, barometric pressure?
Yes. Meaning Google knows what floor of an office building or apartment complex you were standing on.
That is wild. So the mechanics of the geofence warrant executed in Midlothian involved a three-step dragnet process. Think about being caught in this. Step one, Google produces anonymized location data for every single device that appeared within the 150 meter circle during a 1 hour window encompassing the robbery.
Just dots on a map.
Just dots. That means people grabbing coffee next door, people driving past on the street, people sitting in their living rooms in nearby apartments, all swept up as anonymous dots on a map.
And step two involves the police reviewing those anonymous dots to identify suspicious movement patterns. They look for a dot that enters the bank, stays for the duration of the robbery, and then leaves rapidly.
Makes sense from an investigative standpoint.
Right. Once they identify the suspicious dots, they ask Google to expand the tracking window. They demand 2 hours of location data for those specific anonymous devices, revealing exactly where those individuals traveled outside the initial 150 meter geofence.
So they track the digital breadcrumbs of the suspects fleeing the scene. And finally, in step three, the police point to the most suspicious dots and demand the identifying information names, email addresses, and phone numbers.
Unmasking them.
Google handed over three names. One of them was Okello Chatry, who was subsequently charged with the robbery. He fought the charge, arguing that the geofence warrant was an illegal, overbroad search under the Fourth Amendment.
The Supreme Court ultimately agreed with Chatry, but the legal reasoning is what makes this case a landmark. The government advanced a highly technical defense based on a grace period.
A grace period.
Yeah. They argued that in Carpenter, the court established that 7 days of tracking was a search. In Chatry's case, the police only obtained 2 hours of location data. So the government asserted that a mere 2 hours of tracking is simply not enough time to reveal the intimate, comprehensive details of a person's life.
So they were saying 2 hours doesn't count.
Basically. And therefore, it shouldn't trigger Fourth Amendment protections.
But Justice Elena Kagan, writing for the majority, systematically dismantled that argument. She pointed out the absurdity of a time-based threshold for privacy. I mean, even a two-hour window, if it occurs at the right time, can reveal highly sensitive information.
Oh, definitely.
A visit to an abortion clinic, an hour spent with a criminal defense attorney, attendance at a controversial political rally. The court ruled that where the Fourth Amendment applies, it applies regardless of the quantity of information obtained.
Because Google's location history is so precise that it can reliably show someone inside a private home down to the specific floor, accessing even an hour of that data constitutes a search.
However, the government had a second line of defense, and it strikes at the core of how modern technology actually operates. They invoked the third-party doctrine.
Ah, yes.
This is a long-standing legal principle stating that a person has no legitimate expectation of privacy and information they voluntarily turn over to third parties. For example, you have no privacy right in the bank records your bank maintained or the dialed phone numbers that the telephone company uses to route your calls.
And the government argued that Okello Chatry wasn't secretly tracked. They pointed out that Google location history requires a user to physically opt in during the phone's setup process.
You have to click a button.
Right. Therefore, by turning the feature on, they claimed Chatry voluntarily exposed his precise movements to a third-party corporation and consequently forfeited his constitutional protection over that data.
But the court rejected this application of the third-party doctrine, extending the logic they pioneered in Carpenter. They observed that carrying a smartphone is not a luxury. It is a necessity for participating in modern life.
You really can't avoid it.
Furthermore, engaging with these devices requires navigating a labyrinth of terms of service and operating system prompts. When a user opens a mapping application, the phone often warns that the app won't work correctly unless location services are enabled.
The court recognized the illusion of choice here. You cannot expect citizens to wander through the 21st century using a mapless, internet-free flip phone just to preserve their constitutional rights. Clicking, I agree, on a convoluted digital prompt just to make a weather app function does not mean you are meaningfully or voluntarily sharing your exact coordinates 720 times a day with a massive corporate database.
So the Chatry decision solidifies a massive legal wall. If the government wants to compel a tech giant to produce app-derived location history, even for a limited period of time, they must secure a probable cause warrant. It establishes a firm Fourth Amendment boundary against compelled searches of this nature.
Which brings us to the most glaring, almost farcical loophole in American privacy law today.
Let's get into this.
We just established that the Fourth Amendment stops the government from using the power of the state to force a company to hand over this data.
Force being the keyword.
Exactly. But the Fourth Amendment says absolutely nothing about commercial transactions.
Oh boy.
If a private company gathers your location data and simply offers it for sale on the open market, what prevents federal agencies, the military, or local police departments from bypassing the warrant requirement entirely by just swiping a corporate credit card?
Nothing prevents them. And that is the reality of the data broker loophole. We are witnessing the emergence of surveillance for sale. The legal wall built by the Supreme Court is entirely circumvented by just commercial purchasing.
Let's break down how this ecosystem actually functions. When people think of location tracking, they usually think of Google or Apple.
The big guys.
Right. But the data broker market relies on the sprawling ecosystem of random, seemingly innocuous applications on your phone.
Consider a typical smartphone, you know. A user might download a local weather app, a fast food coupon app, a running tracker, and a few mobile games.
Everyone has those.
Embedded within the code of many of these apps are software development kits, or SDKs, provided by location monetization firms. When you grant the weather app permission to view your location to give you a localized forecast, the app is passively harvesting your precise GPS coordinates, your device's unique advertising ID, and your IP address.
And the app developer then funnels this continuous stream of location data into complex ad tech networks in exchange for revenue. And this is where the data brokers step in.
Right.
They operate as massive aggregators. They scoop up this commercially available information, often referred to as CAI, from thousands of different apps. They clean it, package it, cross-reference it, and sell access to it.
Historically, their primary clients were, like, hedge funds analyzing foot traffic at retail stores to predict quarterly earnings, or marketing firms running targeted ad campaigns. But over the last decade, a highly lucrative new client base emerged.
The intelligence community and domestic law enforcement.
Right. These government entities realized they could just purchase the exact same surveillance capabilities that courts were increasingly demanding warrants for.
And we aren't just speaking theoretically here. There are documented real-world examples of federal agencies utilizing this loophole to track suspects without judicial oversight. Let's look at the ATF's use of a tool called WebLock.
Okay.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF, utilized a commercial platform known as WebLock. In a documented case, agents were tracking a suspect, but rather than applying for a warrant for cell site data, they simply logged into the WebLock terminal.
Just logged in like any other software.
Yes. This terminal aggregates location data purchased from data brokers. The agents essentially drew a digital box around a specific location on the WebLock map and queried the system to see if the suspect's device ID appeared there.
So they successfully tracked the suspect's movements across multiple locations using purchased data, completely sidestepping the Fourth Amendment framework. And the executive branch hasn't just tolerated this practice, they have actively formalized it.
They wrote it into policy.
Right. In 2024, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a declassified policy framework for commercially available information.
The ODNI framework is a remarkable document. I mean, it explicitly acknowledges that commercially available information can reveal deeply sensitive details about Americans' lives. Yet the framework formally permits intelligence community agencies to purchase this data.
Data that, if compelled directly from a provider, would unquestionably require a warrant, a court order, or a subpoena.
Exactly. They wrote a policy that essentially says, "We recognize the courts would require us to demonstrate probable cause to demand this data, but since we are simply buying it on the open market, we are authorizing ourselves to proceed."
It's just wild.
The framework does establish internal compliance rules, to be fair. It requires agencies to document their specific mission needs and mandates that privacy and civil liberties officers monitor the purchases.
But critics say that's not enough.
No, critics from civil society and legal advocacy groups have forcefully argued that internal guidelines are inherently insufficient. They warn that this is an executive-level policy drafted by the executive branch for the benefit of the executive branch.
Right, it's grading their own homework.
Precisely. The discretionary standards risk degrading into a mere administrative box-checking exercise, completely devoid of democratic legitimacy or external accountability. The core argument is that intelligence agencies should not be permitted to replace the independent constitutional judgment of the judicial branch with their own internal balancing tests.
I want to pause here for a moment. If you are finding yourself deeply unsettled by this data broker loophole, and you are currently arguing with the air about whether this means America has already crossed the threshold into a functional surveillance state, you are not alone in that debate.
It's a huge topic.
It is. In fact, if you want to explore that specific argument further, the companion debate candy asks directly whether America is already a surveillance state, featuring experts arguing both sides of the issue.
It is a critical debate, particularly when you examine the legislative contradictions surrounding this whole issue, because the way Congress handles commercial data is defined by a massive, glaring hypocrisy.
Oh, absolutely.
We saw a perfect illustration of this contradiction in early 2026 with the passage of the Protecting Americans' Data from Foreign Adversaries Act, or PAFAA.
PAFAA is the irony of all ironies. Let's dig into what this law actually does.
Well, driven by intense national security concerns, PAFAA strictly prohibits data brokers from selling, licensing, or transferring what it defines as personally identifiable sensitive data of U.S. individuals to foreign adversary nations.
We're talking specifically about China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia, right?
Exactly. And the law defines sensitive data incredibly broadly. It covers 17 distinct categories.
Such as?
It includes government-issued identifiers, health diagnoses, financial account numbers, any information pertaining to a minor, information revealing active duty military status, and crucially, precise geolocation data.
And the enforcement mechanism is robust. The Federal Trade Commission was tasked with aggressive enforcement. By February 2026, the FTC had already dispatched warning letters to over a dozen major data brokers, explicitly reminding them that transferring this sensitive information to foreign adversaries carries severe civil penalties of over $53,000 per individual violation.
That's a massive fine per violation.
It is. So we have a situation where the federal government passes a law explicitly recognizing that precise geolocation data is highly sensitive. They officially acknowledge that when this data is aggregated, it poses a dire national security threat.
Right.
It is considered so dangerous that transferring it to Chinese intelligence is a heavily penalized federal offense.
That is the official legislative posture.
And yet, there is virtually no statutory barrier preventing those exact same data brokers from turning around the very next day and selling that exact same sensitive location data to U.S. law enforcement, the DEA, the FBI, or local police departments.
It's double standard.
We fiercely protect the data from foreign adversaries while leaving the domestic purchase loophole just completely wide open.
That is the functional reality of the legal landscape right now. There have been concerted legislative efforts to close this loophole, but they face immense institutional resistance.
What happened to those bills?
Well, the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act successfully passed the House of Representatives in 2024 with a bipartisan coalition. That bill would have prohibited law enforcement and intelligence agencies from purchasing Americans' data from brokers when legal process would otherwise be required.
Sounds great.
However, it completely stalled out upon reaching the Senate.
Of course. And there was also a more comprehensive attempt, right? The Government Surveillance Reform Act, or GSRA.
Yes, the GSRA was introduced by a very unique bipartisan coalition that included progressive Democrats like Senator Ron Wyden and conservative Republicans like Senator Mike Lee.
Rare to see those two on the same bill.
Very rare. The bill aimed to comprehensively close the data broker loophole for federal agencies, imposing strict new warrant requirements across the board. But again, it collided with massive resistance. The White House, the intelligence community, and key congressional leadership opposed it.
Because they like the data.
Agencies that currently benefit from the frictionless acquisition of commercial data have shown absolutely zero willingness to abandon the practice voluntarily. During a contentious Senate hearing in 2026, the FBI director explicitly declined to commit to ending the Bureau's purchases of Americans' location data.
What was their justification?
He argued that the practice was entirely consistent with the Constitution under the third-party doctrine, despite the Chatree ruling. So as of now, both major reform bills remain totally stalled.
So we have established that the digital tracking in our pockets is actively packaged and sold. Let's pivot from the digital world to the physical tracking in our streets.
The camera networks.
Right. We started this conversation talking about China's CCTV network mapping foreign journalists. But over the last few years, the United States has seen a quiet explosion of physical space monitoring. And just like the data broker market, this isn't being built by a central government agency. It is driven entirely by the privatization of surveillance.
And the dominant player in this space is a company called Flock Safety.
Flock Safety.
Flock provides a remarkable case study in how rapidly surveillance infrastructure can scale when deployed through a free market, subscription-based model. Founded in 2017, they manufacture automated license plate readers, commonly known as ALPRs.
But their growth trajectory has been staggering.
By 2025, Flock cameras were operating in over 5,000 communities across 49 states. Their network performs over 20 billion scans of vehicles in the United States every single month.
20 billion scans a month. Let's break down the mechanics of what the camera's actually doing, because these aren't just taking blurry, low-resolution photographs of license plates as cars speed by.
No, not at all. Traditional traffic cameras were largely reliant on basic optical character recognition to read the alphanumeric characters on a plate.
Just reading the numbers.
Right. Flock utilizes advanced machine learning to capture what it calls vehicle signature technology. When a vehicle passes a Flock camera, the system doesn't just read the plate. The AI analyzes the image to identify the vehicle's make, model, and color.
Okay.
Crucially, it also logs highly specific distinguishing features. The system can catalog mismatched body panels, the presence of roof racks, temporary paper plates, specific bumper stickers, and even distinct dents or damage.
I want to play devil's advocate here for a second, because the crime-solving appeal of this technology to local police departments and neighborhoods is immense. I mean, imagine an Amber Alert is issued, or a tragic hit and run occurs. A witness is traumatized and only remembers that the fleeing vehicle was a dark sedan with a roof rack and a dented rear bumper.
That's usually not much to go on.
Exactly. Under the old system, police would be searching blindly. With Flock, a detective can plug those specific visual parameters into the system and instantly pull up every vehicle matching that exact description that drove past any camera in the network. That capability undeniably solves crimes and saves lives.
It does.
And Flock insists they have robust built-in safeguards to protect privacy, right?
Flock Safety heavily emphasizes their privacy architecture in their marketing. They point out that all unflagged data, meaning images of vehicles that are not currently involved in an active criminal investigation, is automatically hard deleted on a rolling 30-day basis.
Okay.
The captured footage is uploaded to Amazon Web Services GovCloud, ensuring it is fully encrypted in transit and at rest.
Yeah.
They also offer features like an HOA safe list, where residents of a pertinent neighborhood or homeowners association can theoretically register their vehicles to opt out of having their own plates logged and alerted upon by their community's cameras.
Deleting the data after 30 days and using government-grade encryption sounds responsible on the surface. What are the practical problems with this deployment?
Well, the problems manifest in the reality of massive scale and the inevitability of systemic misuse. Let's evaluate the accuracy first. In 2026, an independent audit of the Flock system deployed in Roseville, California, yielded alarming results.
What did they find?
The audit found that a staggering 71% of the stolen vehicle or felony alerts sent to the local police department by the Flock cameras were based on misidentified plates. The AI had misread the characters.
A 71% false positive rate for felony alerts is terrifying. A single misread character by an AI algorithm can result in an innocent driver being swarmed by police, pulled out of their car at gunpoint, and subjected to a high-risk felony stop.
Flock deflected the criticism, claiming that Roseville had a unique non-standard deployment configuration. However, they consistently declined to comment on whether they allow independent third-party testing of their algorithm's accuracy rates.
That's a red flag.
But the issue extends far beyond false alerts. The deeper problem is systemic creep and how the data is shared once captured.
Right, because these cameras aren't just installed on state highways. They are purchased by private HOAs, shopping malls, and local businesses.
Exactly. The aggregation of thousands of these seemingly isolated, sparse vehicle sightings across private and public spaces allows law enforcement to reconstruct continuous historical movement patterns.
So they're building a map.
Civil liberties groups like the ACLU point out that combining enough of these localized cameras effectively replicates the comprehensive tracking capability of the physical GPS device used in the Jones case. But it achieves this without requiring the warrant the Supreme Court demanded. Furthermore, the cross-agency sharing architecture creates a massive loophole for state and local laws.
Give me an example of the sharing loophole.
Consider California state law, which strictly prohibits local police departments from sharing automated license plate reader data with federal immigration agencies like ICE.
Okay, sanctuary policy.
Right. However, subsequent investigations revealed that dozens of local police departments were routinely utilizing the Flock platform to share their active databases, vehicle heat maps, and hot list alerts with ICE and Customs and Border Protection anyway, directly undermining state-level sanctuary policies.
Wait, you mentioned heat maps. When Flock initially rolled out, they emphatically claimed their cameras didn't track citizens or create visual databases of movement.
They did make those claims initially. However, through public records requests and investigative reporting, they were forced to acknowledge that their software possesses the capability to generate detailed heat maps.
So it shows where you've been.
These maps visually display everywhere a specific vehicle has been spotted across the camera network over a rolling 30-day period. The discrepancy between their marketing and their technical reality has caused friction.
I would imagine so.
The city council in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, actually voted to revoke its contract with Flock Safety after discovering the company had misrepresented the extent of this tracking capability during the procurement process.
And the search capabilities go beyond just tracking cars. Flock developed a software tool called Freeform, correct?
Yes. Freeform allows police to search the captured video feeds using natural language processing. Public records requests revealed that police departments weren't merely searching for vehicle descriptions. They were utilizing the tool to search for characteristics of the individuals caught on camera.
Like what?
They searched for race, gender, specific clothing colors, estimated height, visible tattoos, and even perceived political affiliations based on the bumper stickers logged by the AI. Flock's newer camera models, specifically the Condor line, are designed to track all moving objects within the frame, actively including pedestrians and cyclists.
Which perfectly explains the immense public backlash. People don't like feeling surveilled without consent. An activist named Will Freeman actually created an open-source, crowdsourced map called D-Flock.
I remember that.
The entire purpose of the project was simply to map where these hidden cameras were being installed so citizens could know if they were being watched in their own neighborhoods. And Flock's CEO, Garrett Langley, publicly labeled the mapping project terroristic and dispatched cease and desist letters.
That confrontation perfectly encapsulates the current tension. When a private surveillance company blankets a city in AI cameras, it is framed as public safety. When citizens attempt to map the surveillance network watching them, the company attempts to classify it as terrorism.
It's a huge double standard.
And the technological envelope is rapidly expanding beyond simple optics. Flock has integrated audio gunshot detection technology called Raven. The Electronic Frontier Foundation issued warnings that these environmental microphones are sensitive enough to pick up and record human voices in public spaces.
So now they're listening too.
The company is also moving aggressively into the deployment of autonomous drones, such as their Alpha drone, which possesses the optics to read license plates from an altitude of 2,000 feet.
This expansion of surveillance technology, physically mapping our movements, collides directly with an area of law where constitutional protections are historically at their weakest, which is the United States border.
The border exception.
We have to talk about the border search exception and how the desire for privacy is increasingly being weaponized as evidence of suspicion.
The border search exception is a long-standing legal doctrine. Historically, it grants Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, extraordinary latitude to conduct searches without a warrant or probable cause at international ports of entry.
Originally, this doctrine was designed to protect revenue, right?
Exactly. Allowing customs agents to search physical luggage for smuggled goods, agricultural contraband, or untaxed items.
But applying a doctrine designed for inspecting suitcases full of agricultural products to a modern smartphone carrying 512 gigabytes of encrypted, intimate personal data creates a massive constitutional gray zone.
It does. And this tension culminated in the highly publicized case of Samuel Tunick. The details of this story require careful nuance, as the legal implications remain unresolved, but it perfectly illustrates the friction between privacy tools and border security.
Walk us through what happened.
Tunick, a U.S. citizen, was returning to the country through an international airport. Upon arrival, he was pulled into secondary screening by CBP officers. They demanded that he unlock his smartphone so they could manually inspect its contents.
And Tunick refused to provide his password. But what made this case significant wasn't just the refusal. It was the specific operating system he was running on his device. He was using Graphene OS.
Precisely. Graphene OS is an open source, privacy and security focused mobile operating system based on the Android open source project. It stripped out the commercial tracking mechanisms inherent in standard consumer operating systems.
It's completely legal to use, right?
It is entirely lawful to install and use. It is widely utilized by investigative journalists protecting sources, human rights activists operating in hostile regimes, cybersecurity professionals, and ordinary citizens who simply value their digital privacy.
But when Tunick refused to unlock the device, the CBP officers didn't just deny him entry, which they can't really easily do to a U.S. citizen anyway. They physically seized the phone.
Under current CBP policy, officers assert the authority to seize devices for prolonged forensic examination, sometimes lasting weeks or months if they suspect a violation of law.
Over a phone OS.
The critical, unresolved debate surrounding the Tunick case is whether the mere presence of advanced privacy tools like Graphene OS, encrypted messaging apps, or complex locking mechanisms can be legally construed as generating reasonable suspicion of illicit intent.
It raises a profound philosophical question. I mean, if I put high security deadbolts on the front door of my house, the police cannot use the existence of those deadbolts as probable cause to assume I am running a meth lab inside and use that assumption to kick the door down.
That's a great analogy.
Taking proactive steps to secure your privacy shouldn't logically serve as evidence of criminality. Yet at the border, the logic often seems inverted. The use of legal privacy tools or the constitutional refusal to surrender a password becomes the catalyst for the state seizing the device.
The legal landscape regarding border device searches is currently fractured. Different federal circuit courts have issued conflicting rulings on whether CBP requires reasonable suspicion to perform forensic algorithmic searches of devices, or whether the historical border exception allows them unfettered access.
Until the Supreme Court definitively resolves the issue, the border remains a space where the digital contents of a traveler's life are uniquely vulnerable to state inspection.
That's the reality right now.
So we need to take all these disparate threads and pull them together. We have discussed intelligence programs filtering the internet backbone. We have examined data brokers legally selling our app-derived location histories to federal agencies. We have looked at private AI cameras logging our vehicles 20 billion times a month. We have seen border agents seizing encrypted devices.
It's a lot of data.
What happens when the AI fusion layer connects it all together?
The fusion layer is the conceptual tipping point. The capability of artificial intelligence to ingest massive unstructured data sets and find correlations changes everything.
How so?
Imagine an AI model that can simultaneously process Flock license plate sightings, Google location histories purchased from a broker, filtered Prism metadata, financial transaction records, public property logs, and social media graphs.
All at once.
When an algorithm can cross-reference your vehicle passing a specific intersection with a ping from your phone's weather app and a credit card purchase at a nearby pharmacy, the resulting profile is terrifyingly comprehensive.
You know, to explain how this fusion works, I like to use the metaphor of pointillism in art. If you look at a painting by Georges Seurat from 1 inch away, all you see is a single, meaningless blue dot.
Right.
That single dot is a license plate read. Next to it is a yellow dot. That's your phone pinging a weather app. Below that is a red dot, a credit card swipe. Individually, none of these data points reveal anything profound.
They're just dots.
But when an AI algorithm steps back and overlays millions of these dots, a high-resolution, unhideable portrait of a human life emerges.
And the integration between the government and the private sector regarding these AI capabilities is deepening. There have been reports of proposals for the government to take direct financial stakes in commercial surveillance and data aggregation firms.
Which is concerning.
Furthermore, government agencies are actively signing broad enterprise agreements with major AI companies to utilize their models for data analysis.
Now, we must maintain our factual guardrails here.
Uh-huh.
When an agency signs an agreement with an AI provider, it does not mean the government is instantly granted backdoor access to read the private conversations of every citizen using that AI's consumer chatbot.
Correct. Enterprise agreements are generally for compute power and specialized model deployment on the agency's own data, not an avenue for mass domestic wiretapping. However, the use of powerful AI to analyze the data they already possess or legally purchase exponentially increases their analytical capability.
This brings us to the ultimate overarching debate of this analysis. Looking at the totality of what we have discussed, do we currently meet the functional definition of a surveillance state?
That is the big question.
I am going to take the position that we are already there. The infrastructure is fully operational. The fact that we do not have a brutalist government building with Ministry of Surveillance carved into the stone above the door is irrelevant.
You think the capability alone is enough?
The capability exists. The data is entirely assembled. It is just being curated via the free market instead of by state mandate.
Yeah.
Our consent is a fiction. We click I agree on a 50-page terms of service agreement simply because we need a map application to navigate to work.
True.
And the oversight mechanisms are riddled with loopholes. Terms like lawful use or authorized purpose are constantly deployed as bureaucratic shields for unconstrained monitoring.
I understand the gravity of that argument. I really do. But I am going to aggressively push back against the conclusion.
Okay, let's hear it.
Having the technological capability to surveil is not synonymous with the routine authoritarian use of that capability. To accurately determine if we are a surveillance state, we have to discard hysterical rhetoric like police state and evaluate the system against specific objective metrics.
Such as?
The scale of integration, the requirement for individualized suspicion, the existence of political targeting, the level of state secrecy, the rights of citizens to correct false data, the rigor of judicial oversight, and the actual consequences for systemic abuse.
Okay, let's measure the American system against those exact metrics.
In the United States, control of the data is massively decentralized. We do not have a single unified dynamic control platform operated by the CIA that fuses all commercial and intelligence data on every citizen into a single interface.
Not a centralized one, no.
More importantly, the system is defined by institutional friction. We have a Supreme Court that, as seen in Chatry, is actively pushing back and forcing the government to obtain warrants for precise location data.
Which is true.
We have aggressive civil liberties organizations persistently litigating against overreach. We have local municipal audits like Oshkosh firing Flock Safety when they discovered the company misrepresented its capabilities. We have states passing their own stringent privacy laws.
So you're saying the friction is the defense.
And fundamentally, we retain actual democratic elections where citizens can vote to remove officials who authorize the abuse of these systems. A true surveillance state, by definition, eliminates friction. The Chinese system we discussed at the beginning does not tolerate lawsuits from privacy advocates or municipal rebellions against state cameras.
But I would argue that the friction you describe is failing. It's a facade. The data broker loophole completely bypasses the Supreme Court's warrant requirement. Congress has repeatedly refused to pass the Government Surveillance Reform Act to close that loophole.
It's slow, yes.
The FTC is empowered to fine brokers for selling sensitive data to Russia, but they are powerless to stop those same brokers from selling it to local police. The friction exists in theory, but the surveillance machine finds a lucrative legal workaround every single time.
The existence of workarounds does not negate the existence of the rule of law. It is a constant evolving game of cat and mouse between technology and policy. But the crucial distinction is that this game is being played in public.
In open court.
It is debated in open congressional hearings, litigated in federal courts, and exposed by investigative journalists. The fact that we know about the ATF using Weblock or the false positive rates of flock cameras proves that the democratic immune system is still functioning, even if it is struggling to keep pace.
Let's try to synthesize this into a defensible conclusion. I think we can firmly agree on the baseline. America is not China. The U.S. government is not building a centralized, state-mandated control platform designed to systematically target political dissidents and monitor the daily associations of every citizen.
I agree completely. We do not have a top-down authoritarian surveillance apparatus.
However, we have undeniably built the exact same physical and digital infrastructure. We just funded the construction through venture capital investments and our own insatiable consumer demand for convenience.
We bought it ourselves.
Their AI-driven cameras blanket the streets. The precise location logs reside on corporate servers. The algorithms capable of fusing it all together are actively learning, which means that the primary barrier preventing the United States from operating as a true surveillance state is no longer a lack of technology.
No, the technological barriers were breached years ago. The only things holding the system back are policy, legal restraint, and democratic oversight.
And that reality leaves us with one final, deeply unsettling question to mull over. If the technological machine is fully assembled and it is quietly idling in the background, and the only thing restraining it is our current legal policy, what happens the day a massive national crisis convinces the American public to voluntarily remove those legal restraints out of fear? The infrastructure won't need to be built. It just needs to be switched on.
That's a terrifying thought.
For more brain candy, companion debate candy, news briefings, and classic audiobooks, visit clarinoratio.com.